Christmas. It can leave you with a sour taste in your mouth, like you're missing out on what it's all about. Or it's the knockout blow at the end of a brutal year. At Christmas, the three words we expect to hear at the bedside of every newborn boy becomes less of a statement and more of a story. A story that expects peace. A story that's about starting fresh. A story expecting life can be beautiful. Expecting beauty in the world around us. Expecting wonder and light. Expecting joy and fulfillment as we work and as we play. Expecting a story that includes us, our hopes and dreams, victories and disruptions, rulers and kings. At Christmas, we can expect a resounding yes that life is like that. At Christmas, you can expect that it's ready to start. This Christmas, try it. Expect to discover gifts from God.
I'm reading from Isaiah 35. Joy of the redeemed. The desert is a parched land. We'll be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the croak, it will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands. Steady the knees that give away. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be open and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer, and with a mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and the streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. In the haunts where jackals once lay, grass and reeds and paras will grow, and a highway will be there. It will be called the way of holiness. It will be those who walk on the way. The unclean will not journey on it. Wicked fools will not go about on it. No lion will be there, nor any ravenous beast. They will not be found there. But only the redeemed will walk there, and those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing, everlasting joy, with crown heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and the sorrow and sighing will flee away.
Thanks, Vicky. If you don't have a Bible, there should be some Bibles underneath your seats if you want to reach for one. This is, you know, this is the book we're going to be looking at this morning, and we're going to be looking at the passage that Vicky read out for us on 496 to 497. I tell you what, I really wanted to. I really wanted to preach a gritty sermon about joy, you know, like a Coen Brothers film or something. I really wanted to talk about the resilience and the hope and the grit and the dirt that it requires to have joy in our world. And by my own standards, I don't think I was doing a terrible job at it either. And it was all true and good. But earlier this week, I was at a Christmas, community Christmas carols event. and you know, you're doing everything you do at an event like that. You're singing, you're dancing, you're watching kids pet baby animals. You're spending far too long in a free sausage sizzle line. You're enjoying the weather. And I realized something, that I was missing out on joy. I was missing out from something about the way that I was feeling about joy. And I realized that because I actually felt joy in that moment. And it felt good. What I'd missed out in trying to wrestle with the grit and the resilience of joy in our world, that joy is actually a really good thing. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. It's light. It's free. Joy is everywhere. And in that moment of clarity, when I realized that I was feeling joy and that I felt good, I'll admit, I shed a tear. Although I shed tears pretty easily. Ask Lil about that moment in The Grinch a couple of years ago. But I was just so thankful to God in that moment that feeling joy actually felt good. The joy was a really good feeling. I'm a vulnerable person, but like, is that okay to say that sometimes we feel good? Yeah, of course. It feels a bit strange, doesn't it? It feels especially strange when I'm telling everyone how good I feel, how good I felt. It feels strange to be vulnerable with such personal emotions, because joy perhaps isn't the first thing off the shelf. For us, there's a whole lot of fear and suffering, anxiety and anger that we need to get through before we even realize that we need joy in our lives. For some of us, there's been this drought of joy, like the millennial drought. Things have been dry and dead for a long time now. And last week, as we kind of started our series in Advent, Steve took us through the story of Joseph. Took us into the story of a man whose life was disrupted by the faith of his fiancée. Like Elaine was just saying, Mary's yes to God's plan took them across the country to his ancestral home in Bethlehem. But in that story, if we understand its context, there was this similar drought of joy that was happening on a national scale. Because our reading that Vicky read this morning was written hundreds and hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus, before any angel visited Mary. And our text this morning was addressed to a people who were going to be taken into exile because of the way that they alienated themselves from God. But this passage, chapter 35, is all about when they're going to return. What they can expect returning back home is going to feel like. It's all about the joy of coming home. And the thing is, they did come home after 70 years. They were exiled in Babylon and they came back after 70 years, but something wasn't quite right. Things weren't the way that they were. Things weren't like what was described in our passage this morning. The second temple had been built to worship God in, and people who were alive to see the first one wept when they saw the second temple because it didn't measure up to the first. The drought of joy remained. Would God really restore his people? Closer to the nativity story, hundreds of years later from Isaiah, between the periods of the Old and the New Testament, a Greek empire had control of Judea. And they'd done everything God commanded his people not to do. They defiled the temple. They slaughtered a pig in the temple courts. They entered the holiest of holies that no one except one priest once a year was allowed to enter. It's definitely not kosher. But Judas Maccabeus, a Jewish priest, led a rebellion to expel this foreign empire out of the land and to restore it as God had promised through the prophet Isaiah, through our reading this morning, only for the Christmas story, Mary and Joseph have to make their way to Bethlehem under the order of another empire, a Roman emperor, probably for the sake of getting the right amount of tax. the drought continued. See, if joy feels good, like I had my experience, the way that history was unfolding for Mary and Joseph, it felt like they couldn't be expecting joy anytime soon. Because what God had promised wasn't looking like it was coming to bear. But the birth of Jesus embodies God's promise that his people will make it home. They will feel joy. And the beautiful thing about the birth of Jesus is that it lets us read this scripture that was written a long, long time ago, before the birth of Jesus. It lets us read it for ourselves. That this prophetic, poetic promise to a people about to be thrown into exile is now for us too. That you can be expecting joy the same way that Isaiah describes it. And that you can expect joy to feel a certain way. Because I think something that comes out of this passage, and we're going to read through it and we're going to look at it, but I think one of the big things that comes out of this passage is joy is feeling the presence of God. Joy is feeling the presence of God. And I think this today's scripture, beyond what we can know about it, it's letting us feel something, kind of like the revelation I had at the community carols. Because we can work our way into thinking that God's doing his thing, but for us, it might not look like joy. You know, joy's off the cards for us. We can't be expecting joy anytime soon. But this passage is promising that we can feel joy. And that we can feel it in really particular ways. We can be expecting for joy to feel big. We can be expecting for joy to feel strong. And we can be expecting for joy to feel like home. The three things we're going to talk about this morning: expecting joy to feel big, for joy to feel strong, and for joy to feel like home. So firstly, expecting joy to feel big. I realise that, you know, saying big and strong, that might come across as quite a Sunday school song. My God is so big, so strong and so mighty. It might also come across as quite masculine. And that if joy is experiencing the presence of God, then that makes God a man. That's not what I'm saying. And that's not what this passage is saying. This passage is saying that joy feels big like a mountain feels big. And we see that at the start because wherever God is present, creation responds. Think about the way that the Bible talks about this. Even if you don't know heaps about the Bible, it starts with the creation accounts. God is present as well as speaking, and creation is worked out all in order. Order out of chaos. Everything is made good because of the presence of God. And the opposite is true as well. When things are judged, creation is subject to that judgment too. When God judges sin, the earth is subject to it. I've been reading Noah's Ark as a kid's bedtime story recently, and it's not a kid's bedtime story. I don't know how to talk about it, especially when I get back to dry land. That's where it starts getting really interesting. But the floods and the water rising to cover the earth is a throwback to the beginning, where there's no order on the earth. God is undoing creation only to do it again, to recreate, to restore creation. So the earth feels the presence of God. And that's what we see in our passage. That's why in our passage, the deserts bloom and they shout for joy because God is here. The crocus, which is a flower, now is a giant image of a flowering wilderness rejoicing because God is here. Even, we get a couple of place names, the mountains of Lebanon and Carmel, We don't have mountains around us, do we? Not like these ones. Not snow-capped all the year around mountains. These mountains, the fertile land of Sharon, they see God in all their glory and splendor. Even the biggest things you can think of see God and God's presence, the joy of God's presence, as big. This is big. This is God creating something new. And because creation feels it, notices God's presence, it can't help but feel joy. There's a natural shift in creation, like a season, but forever. There's a shift that God brings when he draws near and creation pays attention to it. Which I think you might think that's poetry, and it is. It's beautiful. But I think this is also why we make so much of the seasons around Christmas. Now, I'm never going to stop going on about jacaranda trees in our streets because they're beautiful, aren't they? And they tell you what's coming up. I had a little rhyme that I learned as a kid, you know, when the bloom of the jacaranda tree is here, Christmas time is near. The trees are telling you that there's a shift, that something is approaching. For us also, it's, you know, it's the promise of early summer before the heat really sets in and you need to siphon your bathwater out onto your back lawn. There's slip and slides, you know, all of that kind of stuff. There's a shift in the season that tells us Christmas is coming. And in the dark and miserable other side of the world, everyone is dreaming of a white Christmas. Maybe that's why joy is more obvious around this time of year. Because we attach it so close to the seasons, to the creation around us. And these are things that we have no control over. They're big. It might just be a simple blossom on a tree, but who can actually make that tree blossom? None of us. There are things that we have no control over, things that are big and make us feel awe and wonder when they come. Like snow, like purple blossoms, we can be expecting joy to feel big. Because like the seasons changing or the wilderness in bloom, we feel the presence of God who is much, much bigger than us. And because joy feels big, the way that it is strong comes as such a surprise. Because joy is big, the way that it is strong comes as a surprise. Let me explain this with a story. I remember watching Carl Chalmers win gold at the 2016 Olympics. Is it 2016? Where was that? I forget. Rio. There you go. I was watching it in the middle of the Central Markets. There was a TV attached to the roof, and it's like everyone stopped because Carl Chalmers is a Port Lincoln guy, local hometown hero, and he was like 16 or something. And he got out of the water and he looked big. He looked like he was able to win gold at the Olympics. And I was very happy to cheer him on, put my hand over my chest and sing the national anthem. But I, because I wasn't big like he was, I wasn't in any position to be winning gold at the Olympics. And that's the way we usually think about size and strength, right? That the big get to be strong and the small get to be weak. That's not how Isaiah describes it. Here, strength is resilience, not force. And it's exactly because God will come that people can afford to have their hands strengthened. I think we're talking metaphorically, but we're also talking literally. People can afford to have their hands strengthened, their knees steadied, their hearts empowered. It's interesting. This joy is not strong in the sense that it makes people happy. When Isaiah says, "Be strong, do not fear, your God will come," it's not cheer up, your God will come. It's not even strong in the sense that it makes people strong. It's not a declaration of, you know, now be strong, let your feeble hands be strong. The way that Isaiah puts it is it's giving others the strength to do it. He's commanding people in positions of strength to be strong for those who can't be. It's a community that can tell one another, be strong, do not fear, our God will come. It's interesting, isn't it? Strong is both for the big and the small. Joy feels strong and resilient, I think, because it's exercised in community. And I said before that joy is feeling the presence of God. Here, joy feels strong because we can tell one another in the middle of a battle, in the middle of a drought, be strong. Do not fear. Not because of anything that we can do, but because your God will come. He'll come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Now, vengeance, divine retribution, they're tricky words, fearful even. But here, I think God's promise is not only salvation. He's not promising to these people who are about to go into exile. He's not just saying, I'm going to come and bring you back. He's saying, I'm going to deal with the people and the structures and the systems that put you in that position in the first place. I'm going to deal with your sin that you chose to alienate yourself from me. It's vengeance and divine retribution or judgment for all the things that can make your hands weak in the first place. Those people that make your knees weak, not in the good way, and your heart fearful. And then if we continue down in verse 5, for those people in the desperate places of just utter weakness and utter oppression, Isaiah says God will come straight for you. Like the blind gaining sight or the deaf hearing, which again, take your pick, whether it's metaphorical, whether you're blind to something, or whether it's actually physical ailments. God comes and saves those who are in desperate need. So we can be expecting joy to be strong because we can afford to respond to God's presence even before it comes in its fullness. And let's talk about Christmas. This is the message of Christmas, that we can afford to have this joy even before God comes in his fullness. This is the now and the not yet of what it means to live in faith as a Christian. That our joy begins with the presence of God among us. That's where it starts. But we're also waiting for a deeper communion, a fuller kingdom when he returns. And until then, we feel joy's strength as we anticipate the fullness of his kingdom together. It's kind of like the stock market, right? Simple. Not that you'd ever want to compare a relationship to God with money, but Paul, the Apostle Paul, does it all the time, so I'm going to try my best. The way the stock market works, if you know what you're doing, which I can't say I do, I'm not an expert, but people who are willing to spend, to invest in the stock market, buy something before it reaches its full value or its determined value. And they're able to invest down there because they've read the reports. They know the signs. They've got enough information to make a judgment, to invest when things look hopeless, when things look like it's not worth investing in, and they make it because they know it's going to trend upwards. That's what it looks like to live as a Christian, except we have the Spirit of the living God living inside of us. And so we can invest. We can afford to have joy. We can be strong with our joy because we know that the fullness of the kingdom is yet to come. And our hope isn't as shaky as the stock market. So where weak hands are made strong and the blind see and the deaf hear, That's what expecting joy to feel strong looks like. That's what we can expect joy to feel like. And so expecting joy to feel big and strong is all very well, but it's dependent on one thing. It's dependent on one thing, that God actually will come to be with us. And the foundation of this passage is that joy will feel like home. Because if joy is feeling the presence of God, the presence of God is now our home in Jesus. One of the questions I was mulling about in my head as I was preparing this sermon is, what if you went home today and couldn't get back in? How would you feel? For whatever reason, you couldn't get back home. Some of us might have contingency plans, spare keys, neighbours, a trusty high window. That's my plan. I'm not going to tell you which one. But what if you couldn't get back home after this morning? What if even you could walk through the front door, you could get in, but something wasn't right? It wasn't home, it was your house. I think we've all experienced this one way or another, very practically. Maybe you find yourself living very far away from where you were born and you can't get back home. Maybe you've come home one day to find yourself broken into and your home has become someone else's without your permission. Even then, you might walk through a door, be home, but still feel uneasy within yourself. Like, this feeling of home, of belonging somewhere, is difficult because you carry burdens within yourself. And as comfortable as your favourite couch is, home remains a faraway place. As Joseph and Mary represented the Jewish people, this was their situation too. We talked about it in this kind of trading empires who are always occupying their land. They even travelled across the country to give birth to Jesus. They were far from home in a physical sense, but deeper than that, in their distance from the realization of God's promise to them, that he would not only make a home for his people, but he would be there too, they still felt far away. But all of a sudden, in Isaiah's prophecy, we get a picture of the way back home, which is a highway. Isaiah calls it the way of holiness. And that same holiness, that same bigness that gets shown to the mountaintops and the plains at the beginning of our passage, now it's for us. Now it's for those who walk along that highway. And the differentiation between holiness and wickedness here, that it'll be a holy way for those who walk on it and no one wicked will walk along it. I don't think it's that the wicked have no chance. I think it's by virtue of this road being holy because God has established it, anyone who's on it won't be in the category of wicked or unclean, which are biblical categories of wisdom and sacrificial categories for people who are far away from God. And here in our passage, creation chimes in again. Can't help itself, can it? Because there'll be no lions or beasts threatening the way. Only the redeemed will walk there, and those the Lord has rescued will return, and they'll make their way to Zion. But again, it raises the question for Mary and Joseph, this has already happened. It's already happened. They've made their way back home. People have come back to Judea. They've kicked the Greek Empire out. And this promise still doesn't get fulfilled. They're still waiting for this real homecoming. Zion is a poetic place for a poetic name for Jerusalem, kind of like Rattleaid for Adelaide. Not quite, but it's this less poetic. Less poetic, yes, very, very much so. But Zion is this name for Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is where the temple is, and the temple is where God has promised to dwell with his people. And this is where, for us, and for anyone who encounters the Christmas story, our homecoming looks so different to what you might expect. Because in the birth of a baby boy, God has made the earth his home in a totally new way. You see, God has dignified every single person beyond the act of creating them, because now there is a promise of a new home in Jesus, a new creation. So what does this home feel like? I was reminded of a medieval saint who had a pithy short saying. Saint Teresa of Avila talked about what home feels like when she said, in the light of eternity, life, our lives, is just one night in an uncomfortable hotel. So if home is our divine destiny, the amazing thing, the remarkable thing, the unthinkable thing about the Christmas story and Jesus' birth, the incarnation of God, is that he actually stays in that uncomfortable hotel with us. The divine becomes undeniably human. And Isaiah said that there'll be a highway that leads home to God. And the remarkable thing about Jesus is that he says, I am the way. Now, he wasn't just coming up with a cool word that his followers could use to describe themselves, like, I'm a follower of the way. He's actually quoting Isaiah. He's saying, this way of holiness that you're going to walk on, that leads to living with God, I'm the highway. He's made his home on the road with us. And he makes himself at home so, as the passage says, we can be ransomed and redeemed and brought back home. Because unfortunately, not feeling at home is just natural for us, isn't it? It's just natural to not feel at home. Because alienation from God is real. And everything that takes us away from God needs to be dealt with. There needs to be a way back. But Jesus makes himself at home to deal with those very things, our own alienation from God and the things that take us away from him. As Isaiah says, when God comes, he'll bring vengeance and retribution. He's going to judge the things that bring alienation. But the miracle of Jesus is that he comes for that to fall on him and not on us. Think of it this way. All that leads us away from God, for Jesus, becomes a way back to him. And that's what joy feels like, finding a way back home. At Christmas, we're given a chance to respond to the reality that we are going home, while at the same time it's being made around us as we live and breathe. Creation is being restored. For us to enter Zion is to walk with Jesus. And expecting joy to feel like home means accepting God has made his home right here. And I get it. You might be here and you might be thinking, but I've never felt at home. It's more natural for me to feel homeless than to feel like a place, like I've got a place to rest my head. And you've never felt that joy. You've never been given the chance to. Too much of this, too little of that. A life too messed up to enjoy. But the promise of God in Jesus is for Jesus to dignify this world with his presence means that this is the creation worth making new. And for Jesus to dignify this world with his presence means that he's serious about doing it. And that's the feeling of joy. Knowing that Jesus has come to make creation new and that he's serious about doing it, and it starts with you. That's the feeling of joy that rests on you like a royal crown, like Isaiah says. It's the feeling of joy that always stays ahead of you. It's always overtaking you, Isaiah says. My grandparents love to tell the story of when they first got together and they first married. And it's a pretty good story. They were married in the 50s, not their 50s. And they settled down in West Croydon. It's not too far from here. And before any kids came onto the scene, they talk romantically about those early days, about having to eke out a living, making do with what they had. Their eyes light up when they talk about the apple crates that they used as furniture. I don't think because they're particularly comfortable, but because of what they represented. The joy of finding a home together. Those apple crates were theirs. It helps that I picture it in black and white, because that's what it was like back then, right? But for joy to be in our lives, we need to feel at home. And expecting joy is not expecting a perfect home. It's experiencing a place where the ups and downs of life actually make sense. Because beyond newlyweds, the joy of home is a place to belong, to shelter, and to rest. For housemates, for people who own their own home, for those in spare rooms, for those who don't know where they're going to land tonight, the joy of home is a place of connection, of friendship, and of peace. Whether it's a dog, a cat, I'm with Steve on that one, a housemate, a neighbour, a child, whether it's in the quiet or the excitement of coming home, home can be found in a crowd, can be found in a bedroom, can be found across a table or in a row of seats like these. Home is a place where life's up and downs make sense. Home is a place to make sense, and home is a people to make sense of those up and downs with. And our text this morning is all about coming home, of a people to their place. And I think what it says is that all of us can expect to feel joy like that, to feel joy like you've come home. But as we've seen, the promise of homecoming means it's being spoken to a homeless, to a broke down people, people who've experienced more of life's ups than down, who don't have someone to come home to, who are lost in exile, confused. But at Advent, the promise of God making home with us reignites this text with a wonderful light. This Advent, you can expect joy to feel like home. I'm going to invite the band up. Because everything that robs you of joy, everything that alienates you from God, Jesus has taken that on himself. That's why he's dignified us, humanity, with his presence. Because all that is away from God, Jesus uses it to make a way back to God by dying on the cross, by showing God's eternal love, showing us the true heart of the Father who wants to see his children come home. You can trust that joy is a good thing to feel this Advent. You don't need to be scared. Do not fear. It's good because it's big and it's strong, and joy feels like home. If you're here this morning and you're looking for a sense of home, for a real place or real people, if you're looking for the goodness that God's presence brings, I want to encourage you to step onto that highway, to walk with Jesus. After this last song, we have people praying up the front. And if you want the reminder or the invitation for the first time to come home, to step onto that highway, we would love to do that with you. To know joy.